Will you please, for the record, just state your name and birthplace and year of birth?
Yes, my name is Valerie Danby Smith. I was born in Dublin in 1940.
So you were born in Dublin, Ireland, and now you are in Montana. So that's a long journey from here to there. And why? What were some of your childhood memories of Dublin, your earliest memories?
Well, of course, the memories are really more of childhood than of Dublin. I mean, it took me a little while to be aware of where I was, what country, what city. But growing up in Dublin was probably very like growing up almost anywhere else. It's a small city, but very cosmopolitan. We had everything there, everything that we needed. And I think one early on became aware of being Irish because Ireland had been occupied for 700 years by the British by the time I was growing up. And so that certainly featured in our upbringing that although there was no sort of hatred against the British, it was just that we were very happy to be free and having our independence meant that there was a great emphasis on Irish culture, on everything that was Irish, when I was growing up. Now, indeed, my mother was British. My father was Anglo-Irish. He was Protestant. So, in fact, I had very little pure Irish, in terms of that. But because my mother was a Catholic, I grew up an Irish Catholic, which is a very distinct type of person, and I think most of the people who emigrated to America from Ireland were Catholic. I mean, there was really no reason for Protestants to leave. They were the ascendancy, and they had the wealth, and they were a minority too in the South. But had an unusual childhood in that, apart from my parents being not the ordinary Dubliners, my father was from County Carlow, my mother was from London. When I was three, they separated. My father went and lived in England and spent the rest of his life in England. And my mother went to England for a while, so my older brother, and I were put in a boarding school. And so from three to, I just turned 17 when I graduated from high school. I spent all those years in a boarding school, and in the summers and holidays were spent at a little hotel. So I didn't have a family upbringing. I had a completely unusual upbringing, which was absolutely wonderful. School I enjoyed immensely because I loved to learn. Ireland, well, I think the world at that time wasn't the way it is now, where everything is judged by how much you have, what you have, acquiring things. The upbringing we had was you acquire knowledge, and knowledge was the only interesting thing to acquire, and school was where you acquired it. And so I absolutely loved school. And funnily enough, I had a reunion a year ago when I was in Ireland, and 16 of the 20 who were in my class were there. Two d have died. The other two, one was in Boston visiting her son, the other was in Barbados with family. The 16 have all done immensely well. I mean, everybody made their mark in some way, which has to be I'm sorry, searching for a word, a great the school has to be recommended for that because excellence, the standard was the highest. There was nothing, there was no second class or third, no everyone's good or average is great. There was nothing like that. It was do the very best you can, and that's the only way to go. And I did the same with my children when they grew up. And I'll tell you, it works very well. But I think that's part of an Irish trait. I'm just going to say the school was a credit to the school. It was it has to be given the credit for how many of, and I know many students. I just spent a month in Europe, in Italy, part of the time with three girls who went to school with me. And again, I mean, they've all had extraordinary lives. So that is something that comes from the Irish background, where we didn't, your possessions, nobody cared what you had. Nobody had any cars. We didn't. We had a pony and trap to go to church. And I mean, if you were lucky, mostly you walked, but if you were lucky, you were given a seat in the trap going off to church. The knowledge was the that was the main element of my childhood.
And when you were in this school, what did you discover about your pursuit of knowledge? Like, what is the thing in school that you latched onto and committed yourself to for learning?
Well, I mean, it wasn't anything. It was all pervasive. It was that you were interested in everything and you followed everything and you did everything to the best of your ability. And that the learning in itself was the fun. And we did have lots of fun, but it was based on, well, a classical learning and but also Irish studies, because that was a very new subject. In that we were studying the Irish language, you had to study. And the people who were teaching us were not native speakers. They'd had to study it to teach it to us. And the Irish literature, most of the Irish literature in English was all Anglo-Irish, you know, in Yeats. I mean, if you go back through Goldsmith, all of the people who wrote, the famous writers, pretty much were Anglo writers. Now we were coming into our own, because there was some great writing, but it was in the Irish language, but nobody could read it because nobody learned it, you see. So that was one of the pleasures of childhood, was exploring this aspect. I mean, first of all, it was a difficult language, and so it had, I mean, it had certain drawbacks. I mean, that wasn't pure pleasure. English was pure pleasure, but the Irish had difficulties, and you really had to study it. And of course, the children who had gone to Irish schools, although I went at three, I mean, the school was junior school and senior school, and in junior school, well, there were a lot of young children and a lot of children whose families had been divided by the war, or their parents were overseas. Mostly, the Irish worked for the British Empire. I mean, it's a small country, an agricultural country. There weren't many jobs. So people went to England to work. And a lot of in my school friends, their parents were in South Africa or India or some far-flung area in the British Empire. And so Irish was sort of a very strange thing to thrust upon these children. But the children who had come from, who did their junior school in Ireland, and if they went to one of the free schools, the national schools, they learned almost everything through Irish. And they were way ahead of us. And there was a system where you had to speak Irish. Your exams, if you failed Irish, you failed everything. If you took your papers in Irish, then you got 10% on everything. You could say, I want my mathematics paper in Irish, and then you got 10%, even though Irish had nothing to do with it. I mean, the sums were the sums, or whatever it was you were doing. But anyway, I found it very interesting and exciting, because I caught on very early in life that if you had an education, it could take you anywhere you wanted to go. And if you didn't, you were pretty much stuck and at the behest of others.
And I find it. Oh,
just a second.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just going to adjust your microphone. So
tilted a little.
Is it? Did it turn?
It turned a little bit, and I'm actually just going to put it on the other side.
Put it on the other side, yeah.
And if I could just clip it right.
Sure.
There. That'll be perfect.
Okay, but you've got it on your.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got it. So
no,
it's, yeah, it's not.
No,
it's not
problem.
A problem.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm finding very interesting as you're talking about this awareness as a child about your heritage and being in Ireland and what it is to be Irish after this control over the country, and then your language, which is such a root of a person, and you obviously mm-hmm. have a passion for it. Is there anything in like sayings or things that have stuck with you from that time that you were studying it, thoughts and proverbs and things like that that feel very much ingrained in that?
Well, I mean, a lot of things, but it's hard to initiate a conversation out of nowhere. I worked for Guinness for 10 years in New York, uh-huh. and speaking Irish was a very useful thing because we had a lot of Irish, whether they were diplomats or personalities or whatever, people came over to America, and Guinness was the sort of entertaining element because we always supplied the beer. So I got lots of opportunities to speak.
Speak, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we didn't speak in Proverbs, you know, I mean,
no,
any
no,
more than
I mean,
you would
in
speak
school,
in Proverbs.
You know, when you,
in school,
when
we didn't
studying,
speak in Proverbs,
no,
we either, but you know, we spoke as you and I are speaking now,
right. Oh,
but it's very hard to have a conversation where you don't have someone to speak with,
right.
As it were. We learned a lot of Irish poetry,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
was great fun, and it was, I mean, that was an easy way to learn a language. Well, because, of course, it rhymed, or it sort of rhymed.
Who's your favorite Irish poet?
Well, a lot of them were anonymous because this was all, I mean,
right.
all of these had been written in the 17th and 18th century, but, you know, under, I mean, it was not allowed. The language was forbidden.
Right.
So there wasn't an Irish poet. I mean, if you're talking about in Irish,
mm-hmm.
you know, Antony O'Rafferty would be one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if I can remember one of his. He's got one that's Anishtiacht an Arig beg an Lod al Conchino is Threshnail breed er doing me maciol. O hir me maciane ni stopic me shiha gashasic me shi sergler gandhi me o. But it's you know, but language has to have two people, and you have to be mm-hmm. at least two
mm-hmm.
and more, and you have to be speaking it. But we learned reams and reams and reams of poetry, which was, and it's a different kind of, I mean, it's not even remotely like English,
right.
or Anglo-Saxon. It's more, well, it's a Celtic language. It's more, well, it's got more German in it, I think. Not German roots, but the type of...
Mm-hmm.
guttural sounds
the sound is so beautiful in the poem that you
mm-hmm.
just spoke, and you can definitely, you know, see the vein in the language and the placement and things like that, and you,
mm-hmm.
you speak it so connectedly. Do you what is the rough translation of the poem? What is that?
Well, it says spring is coming, and Rafferty was a blind man. In fact,
mm-hmm.
most of the poets, and I think like today, a number of musicians are blind, because what can you do? If you're blind, you're limited, and you can't be a tradesman or a craftsman. So a lot of the writers were the ones that have survived were blind.
Mm-hmm.
Rafferty said, spring is coming, and I'm off on my journey. The spring is coming, the days are getting shorter. I'm going to get on my way, and I won't stop for anything until I reach County Mayo. See, I think he was in the Dublin side of things, and then he would go wandering, because the poet would create his poems, and then he would go, and people would give him shillings or pennies or whatever they gave him, and that was the way he lived. So he would go off to the country places as it became the weather got better, and then I suppose he'd be in a place like Dublin for the where he'd maybe get shelter in the winter months.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm just picking you up on the mic during the responses.
Oh.
So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Going back to, aside from the language, and you talk about again your experience with your identity, what are some of the traditions that you remember engaging in at your school, or things that still to this day feel very Irish?
There wasn't an emphasis on Irish, well, apart from history and language. And I went to a Catholic school, so the emphasis was 100% on religion. So we didn't have Irish holidays, we had religious holidays. There only is, as far as I know, one Irish holiday, and that's St. Patrick's Day, but that was a religious, when I say as far, I mean the St. Bridget's Day, which is actually the day that Rafferty, because it was the 1st of February, so the Feast of St. Bridget, but that's the first day of spring too. So we didn't have Irish traditions as such, and we didn't have any special food because all the food was Irish. I mean, it was what you ate. It was bread and butter, sugar and milk, jam, meat and potatoes and turnips and cabbage. It wasn't, nobody said this is Irish food. This was what was in the garden at the time of the year that it was there. And you had it. The school I went to, everything, well, and even at home, I mean, nothing was bought. Everything was produced from the land. And we didn't think about it. So we didn't have any, other than religious, there were certain religious ceremonies. And St. Patrick's Day was a day where we had extra long mass and high mass and singing. We didn't wear green. I mean, no one even thought of wearing green. I don't know if that's a completely American thing of wearing green, that maybe the Irish, when they left Ireland, we used to wear a little bit of fresh shamrock in, on your uniform. You had just a little bit of fresh shamrock. I've a story when I was working for Guinness, we arranged for shamrock to go from Ireland to the Caribbean somewhere. It might have been Jamaica or someplace. And when someone from the embassy got to the party, they said, "Where's the shamrock?" And they looked and said, "Well, no," because they said, "Did the shamrock arrive?" "Oh, yes, it arrived." "Well, where is it?" "Nobody's wearing it. It was in this," they thought it was like cress. They put it in the sandwiches. But that's the only thing. We never had bits and pieces of stuff, "I'm Irish, kiss me, I'm Irish." That sort of thing, is as far as I can make out, a complete American invention. We hadn't. It was the little piece of shamrock was, it was a dual thing. I mean, the shamrock is the sort of emblem of Ireland, but it's also the emblem of the Trinity. And it was when St. Patrick was trying to teach the pagan Irish the concept of three persons in one God, he took up a shamrock. And that's how the shamrock became both the emblem of the Trinity and the emblem of Ireland. So in my growing up, there was really no distinction between being Irish and being Catholic. Now, I've never discussed this with the Protestant side of my family, but mainly because I never knew them. The Catholics and Protestants didn't speak in my day, and so therefore I never knew my father's family at all when I was growing up. I met them much later. And let's see what else we did. And at home, there really weren't. At home being the hotel, it was a hotel. The we must have had, we had little things, and I don't know that they were particularly Irish or whether they were of that time, but on Easter Sunday, there was always our Easter egg hunt was, there was one turkey egg that was hidden in the hearth, and it was called the hob, the hearth was, and whoever got up first would find, well, usually my brother found the turkey egg, and he got a half crown. I don't know, in those days, maybe it was worth about 50 cents, something like that.
Would you guys have a competition to see who could get up first? And he just saw
It wasn't really a competition. It was, in that, we would try it, but my brother always, the thing is, we had lots of duties. I had, as a girl, had far more duties than he had. Therefore, he was sort of free to get up there and find that, because I had to do the things I had to do. And then by the time I remembered, oh my goodness, the thing. So I don't believe I ever found it.
What were you?
The turkey. But the other thing was that you had to eat the turkey egg. And I wasn't all that crazy about eating a turkey egg. It's much bigger. I think it's just a little bit more gamey, I suppose, than a hen egg. Duties were, they were just endless duties. in a house, a big house that's a hotel, that was more setting of tables and getting things ready, getting things ready for breakfast. Breakfast in Ireland is always a big deal. It was like, not the main meal of the day, but you always had a hot breakfast, and often with bacon and eggs and sausages and black and white pudding and mushrooms and tomatoes and fried bread. It was a big deal. Needed a lot of preparation. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And what time was breakfast generally served?
Breakfast, I would say, was probably at 9 o'clock. Things are much later over there, still are, than here. Nobody gets up at 5, or nobody that I know of. Unless you're in some obscure business where you have to. People tend to have a much later day. Or at least when I'm saying that, I'm thinking of more when I lived there. I don't know that today maybe it's more like America. Every place seems to be more like America now. People have adjusted their things because of work and the work ethic and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Let's see if were there other. There were a lot of things that really weren't. I wouldn't say they were. What did you ask? The whole fabric of life was. It was different in the sense that I think the Irish are much more, they're storytellers and sort of a bit fanciful about things. We had a lot of fairies and leprechauns were a natural part of existence. Not at school, because they didn't come up. The nuns didn't have any time for that. That was, but I know that fairies, if things were missing or you couldn't find something, it generally had something to do with a fairy having moved it from one place to another or something in your behavior. There were a lot of things like that, and that was more country, because actually I spent my holidays not in Dublin, but in County Wicklow. And so that was, which was closer to the land. And so definitely there were lots of tales of fairies. And fairies are mischievous people. They're not, I think here we think of fairies being pretty and nice. They were not nice. They were very ugly and unpleasant people. And the thing is, you had to be very nice about them, because otherwise they did bad things to you. And they were called in Irish, but they're called the good people, and you had to call them the good people because you knew they were bad, and if you called them bad, then bad things would happen to you. So there's that sort. There was a lot of fanciful stuff that was part of life, and it was nothing to do with children. It wasn't children think that. It was actually adults thought that much more. I mean, children were more likely to say, gosh, I don't believe that, the way often children will say, I don't believe in Santa Claus. You know, but everything had there was a logic to it. And I mean, for instance, Santa Claus wasn't Santa Claus. Because, I mean, Santa Claus, the original Santa Claus, which, as you know, and with your Greek heritage, you know, it's from St. Nicholas. So was St. Nicholas bringing gifts? It wasn't this imaginary man that does he exist or doesn't he exist. Of course saints exist. And if you're good, you get gifts, you get presents. And you know, so that there was a logic to it. It wasn't now things have come in us, that we've lost touch with the roots and the roots of sort of the stories of who we are, I think. And that part of that is big cities. I think it happens in cities. But it also happens in when we have a workaday life and we work hard, and then with our money we go out and we buy stuff, and then our places are absolutely stuffed with all of these objects. And whereas we didn't have any of that thing, so we spent endless hours in the winter evening sitting around the fire telling stories. And if there was, as there was, I mean, the house I grew up in actually was built, a little beautiful Georgian house that was built in 1802 and had for a century belonged to the family of a great writer, Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu. And all sorts of wonderful people would have been at that house. Oscar Wilde's dad would have been there. Bram Stoker would have been there. I mean, the house had immense history, and it was a beautiful building. And it was an absolute treasure to grow up in it, you know, to have that and to know, to understand, you know, and to understand who had been here, you know, that, I mean, Bram Stoker wouldn't have written Dracula there, but he certainly would have talked about it and might have got some ideas. But so that, you know, when the wind whistled through as it did, there were lots of ripples and noises and they made you think and they made you fantasize. And this was, I mean, you couldn't go into any store anywhere in the world and buy the childhood that I had. You know, you couldn't, and I couldn't give it to my children either. I mean, so in one way, one was underprivileged and not growing up with any family or parents. But in another way, I had a life that was richer than you can imagine. Yeah,
that I love that, and just talking about the almost spiritual nature of the place. And it sounds too, you know, with you talking about the food and the connectedness, that there is a deep connectedness to the land, mm-hmm. and the earth, and it's very grounded. And do you have any favorite stories that you remember from childhood about the mischievous fairies? And
well, they're not really, because you never told the same story twice. You invented. You just invented. There was no thing, and everybody joined in the invention.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a story that was told over. It was that you used your imagination to build on it. So whether it's a noise or whether it's the clock ticking or something or a mouse suddenly appearing from a hole, and you know, all of those things would get together. And then all of a sudden, everybody joins in the story, because of course we had big extended families, they weren't my family, but we were a family. So there were aunts and uncles and cousins, and you know, I grew up with around 15 or 20 people all the time. You know, when we sat down to a meal, there were a good 15 sitting down at the table. And so everybody contributed. And if you said, like, what was the story? It changes with the moment, because we did it every day all the time, and nobody was saying the same thing over and over. You were trying to invent and be different. So it's hard for me to, you know, if I were, you know, if my brother was here with me, we could probably, you know, create that sort of a thing. But it's hard sort of out of nowhere to just bring it up. But I just remember watching the flames, the turf didn't, it was very slow burning, but sometimes if it was very cold, we put some anthracite or coal on top of it, and then you got some lovely flames. And then the creaking, and you had to be very close and by the fire, because the houses, of course, weren't heated at all. We didn't have, you know, we had hot water, I think, on Saturdays, that was it. I mean, there were a whole lot of things that were different, but it's amazing how you can do without. I mean, of course, if you've never had such a thing. In school, we had cold water every day. I mean, you never had hot water, and it was cold. We're not talking about, you know, say here in the summer, it's nice, you wouldn't mind washing in cold water, but it was even when it was freezing, we had cold water. We never had hot water to wash in. But we didn't, you didn't know of hot water, so you didn't know that you were missing anything, you know, and you just did everything as quickly as you could, you know, so that you didn't have to dwell on how cold and miserable it was, those sort of things. And then when at home, and on the Saturday night, you know, there'd usually be two or three cousins and my brother and myself, and then in a order of age, the bath would be drawn, and the oldest would go in, and by the time the youngest went in, it was cold and dirt scummy water, but that was the way it was. You know,
were you,
I mean,
the
no, I was, no, I was the, I was, in, Peter was 2 years older than me, and then there were a couple of cousins, and one was between Peter and me, so that I was third, and then there were two others, so I was four, I was third, and there were two younger. But, you know, it varied, though, sometimes different people were there. But it was that sort of thing that you just sort of got on with life. And so I have very little patience with when people sort of complain and say, that things aren't, things aren't exactly the way they want them to be. I mean, when I think of the things that we enjoyed, I mean, we didn't dwell on the drawbacks. We dwelled on the, you know, the good things. And that was the only way to do it and come out of it very well.
What sort of play did you engage in as a child? What sort of toys did you play with?
We didn't have toys, and we really, play was not encouraged at all, you know. Children, I mean, it's a whole different thing, you know. When you were home, you were expected to work, to do chores. The idea of playing was considered silly and useless. And I know my brother had a Meccano set, which was, it's sort of like a precursor to Lego, but it's with metal and screws and nuts and things. I don't ever recall having a toy of any kind. We played outside, but you get sticks and stones and pieces of wood. That was it. And you invent things. So at school, we played with leaves. We made houses. In the fall, we swept up leaves and made little houses out of them and used stones as whatever items for our house, and a branch of a tree as a sweeper thing and that. I mean, we early on, we got interested in sports. I mean, I think you started playing tennis maybe at 9 or 10, you know, you started. Sports, we played sports, tennis and rounders and cricket and I'm trying to think what else. But those were the main ones, I think. Tennis was very big. School girls played hockey and netball, which is a form of your basketball. Boys played basketball and girls played netball. And sports were sort of serious things. But at home, And then in the morning, because it was so very cold, you know, you really couldn't, it was cold inside and out. So no one was sitting nicely, playing with something. It was always too cold. So generally speaking, we were moving all the time, you know. And if you were in the house, I remember sitting down and reading a book was considered, at home, that was considered a great waste of time. You know, so if anyone saw you sitting reading a book, they'd say, oh, get up, dust that, bring this, bring in some coal, bring in some, you know, feed the chickens. You know, if anyone saw a child sitting down, that was a detrimental thing. So you had to sort of find a spot where nobody was going to see you.
Chickens, you had chickens,
chickens, pigs, everything. Oh, everything. It was because people lived off the land, you know, and the difference, all the food came from the land. Yeah. So if you wanted to eat a chicken,
right.
Well, you killed it. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody was going down to the butcher shop. There actually was a little butcher shop in the village, which was close to where I spent my holidays. But pretty much everything was on the farm. Yeah, so there was lots to do.
And how long were you in Dublin? What part of your life, and when did you come to the States?
Well, I came to the States when I was, actually, I was 20. I was almost 21. I was in Dublin till I was 18. 17 and a half, really. I went over to England and spent some months there, and then I went on the continent and worked in Europe for a year and a half or 2 years. And then I came to the States two or three times, just actually passing through. And then I came back because I was offered a job, and it was just going to be a 2 or 3 or 4 month job. And anyway, then I was offered another job and another job. So they were all very, very interesting jobs. So I decided, you know, just one thing after another. Mm-hmm. I found I was staying because you always think, well, I can go home. And so I never intended to stay. I never imagined I would stay in America. It was an interesting place, but it wasn't a place that I would have chosen. I wouldn't have packed my bag and said, now I want to go to America, because there were so many other places I wanted to go to. And America, I just felt, is always there, you know. Because growing up, you knew a lot of Americans, Yanks, we called them. And, you know, you thought, well, that's always there, but why would I go there? I want to go other places. Irish are great travelers, great journeymen. They were going from place to place. They love to travel, see other cultures. I mean, I've never gone to a place where I haven't met someone who is Irish, mm-hmm. which was interesting. I remember when I first came to America, it used to annoy me. I came to New York and people were saying, oh, we know someone who's Irish. And I was thinking, why would I want to meet someone? If I wanted to meet an Irish person, I'd go back to Ireland. You know, there was a great thing in America because it's different now, actually, because there's so few actual first people who've come over, immigrants from Ireland. I mean, they come and they go. They come, they're here a little bit. So now if someone tells me, you know, there's someone from Ireland, say here in Montana, I might go looking for them and say, but when I first came to Ireland, to America, I thought, I want to meet Americans. I don't want to meet Irish people. I want to get away from, I know all about that. I want something entirely new. Mm-hmm. And I was remember staying with a cousin of mine out in Great Neck, Long Island. He was a doctor and he married an American woman. And they were great in my childhood. I remember coming, they came back to Ireland, and it was when there was that idea when the Americans came, they had lots of money. They had money, and she had great glamour. She's still alive, actually, at 92 now in New York. But she, it was sort of enchanting when I remember she brought me this little red it was a very fine corduroy, bright red with a hood, like a little Red Riding Hood coat from, I was 10, I think, from Lord & Taylor. I mean, Lord & Taylor, Fifth Avenue, that was like, you know, something in my mind when I was coming to New York. I wanted to see Lord & Taylor. But Aunt Helen and Uncle Larry. But when I stayed with, I was working in New York City, but I went out to them some weekends, and I was playing the recorder at the time. And so they said, well, if you want to play that, you have to go down to the basement, to the laundry room. So I was in the laundry room, and they said, well, you know, once you're down in the laundry room, take down the laundry. We know, typical Irish, take down the laundry and put it in and do it, and then you can play your recorder. And while I was there, the super came, the super of the building. And he said to me, he said, oh, you're with the Dunns, aren't you? I said, yes. And he said, well, you know, I can get you a much better job with another family. You'd get, I'm sure you'd get a lot more money or something like that. So I thought this was hilarious. And I went upstairs and I told them. They were absolutely furious because, you know, at that time, a girl who came from Ireland would be a maid. I mean, that's if you're, and you're in the laundry room doing the laundry, the only reason you'd be there is because you're the maid. And that was the pretty much the standard. I mean, I was working for Newsweek magazine at the time, you know, as a journalist. But anyway, I thought it was very funny, but they were, I always remember how mad they were. And I thought, like, oh, gosh, you know, I could have got a better job maybe. Anyway, that was one of the sort of the cultural things, because of course what happened with a lot of the Irish who came to America came because there was no work in Ireland, which was one reason I left Ireland, not why I came to America, but I left Ireland looking for work. And a lot of them found, if they were young girls, they found jobs in service. You know, that was the fact of the matter at the time. Anyway, that was one thing about Ireland. I mean, a lot of the, well, I think a number of educated people did leave too, because quite a few of my contemporaries at school were in New York at the time. Molly Hayes was one of the first women to have her own seat on the stock exchange. Ursula Beery was one of the lead writers for Time magazine. Anne Halley was a well-known sportswear designer. And Anne Tolan was the voice of Ireland for Aer Lingus. And she's now see her at the Metropolitan Museum, where she's a patron of one of the departments there. But, you know, I mean, all of these people came and they did things. And they were all, you know, we were all kids together in school.
Yeah. The first time that you left Dublin, was it for a specific job going somewhere? Or was it going to, you came directly to New York from Dublin, is that correct?
No, I went to England where I met my family when I was 16. That summer I spent in England and on the continent in France and Spain and Portugal. And then when I was 17, I went back and spent the summer in London and, well, in other parts of England working. And then when I was 18, I went to live in Spain. Mm-hmm. And then when I was almost 21, I came to America. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was your first job in America? What eventually kept you here? When did you realize that you weren't going back to Ireland?
Well, when I married an American, yeah. That's the that's the only. My first job, I worked for the production, the Hostage on Broadway, the Brendan Behan play. I worked for that with that production. That was the first job. Then I worked for Samson Raphaelson, who wrote the first, well, he did a lot of wonderful plays, but his The Jazz Singer became the first talkie movie. And then I worked for Newsweek. Newsweek actually asked me if I'd work for Raphaelson until they had a space. And then I worked in publishing and so on. And You know, when I came to America, I just never, ever imagined I would stay here. And when I married my husband, who was a physician, his intention was to work in an underdeveloped country. Now, if I'd known that wasn't going to happen, I probably wouldn't have married him, because we had planned to be in Africa, and he had, and all his work had been with that in mind, and that was a country that's always interested me, and I've spent a certain amount of time there. But as it happened, and then I put my oldest child in school in Ireland, thinking we'll be in Africa, and you have to put them down at birth if you want to get them into a good school, you know. So, but then it turned out that the underdeveloped country we came to was Montana. His brother had moved from Africa to here and said, well, they really need doctors in Montana, and therefore we should come here. And so that's how we came to Montana. I never imagined we would stay here.
What year did you come to Montana?
1980 I came. He came in 1979. And I said, if you stay there a year, I'll move. But to move children out of terrific schools in New York City, four children, was and come to Montana was, it was a difficult thing to do, you know. So, I came here, he stayed a year, and he stayed more than a year, and we moved here to Bozeman. And we lived in the country up Bridger Canyon, and everybody loved it because of horses and all sorts of skiing and hunting and water sports and everything. It was like a heaven after New York. I mean, more for the kids. I had a fabulous job at the time. I was working for Guinness. You couldn't have worked for a better place. I had a big job there. And it was, I enjoyed it immensely. And it meant I got back to Ireland frequently. And at that time, my oldest boy was in school in Ireland. And so coming to Montana really was quite a change for us. Now, I did end up sending all the children back, but to the East Coast school, because they'd started on classical educations, and there was no comparable thing here. So they did all go away to school, but they really enjoyed Montana. And in fact, as I mentioned to you earlier, the living in Montana, in fact, brought me away from Ireland, because living in New York and working for Guinness was tantamount to be living in Ireland. I mean, I was with Irish and English people all the time. We got back on business and other things. I was absolutely in a milieu of Irish culture at its best. So when I came to Montana, I was completely divorced for the first time from my Irish background.
Have you, during your time in Montana, have you found any of that Irish heritage or pockets of culture here in Montana?
There's an Irish American culture here, which is, it's really American Irish. And some of that, it's very interesting. I'm thinking more in Butte. There's really no Irish culture here in Bozeman. I mean, there's a little bit of Irish music. I have three or four Irish-born friends. We get together every now and then. But there really isn't anything cohesive here. But in Butte, there's an extraordinary group of people and sort of generations of people, a sort of spin-off from the first miners who came from Cork when the mines closed down there from Irish and settled in Butte. And I have retained so much of that. Now, on the little clip I saw of this, there were, in fact, several people that I knew who, as they used to say about the Anglo-Irish, they're more Irish than the Irish themselves. For the first time in my life, when I went to Butte, I used to get into arguments about Irish politics, because I was definitely, we all were Republican. I mean, all Irish Catholics pretty much were Republican. Well, there were a few exceptions, but Republican growing up. Republican, I mean Irish, not American Republican. And but then you grow out of that, and especially I worked, apart from working for Guinness, I worked with John Hume, the Nobelist, on working on a solution for the settlement of the Irish question in the North. I mean, I'm very familiar with that. I've worked with the Irish government, with John Hume on a special project. And, you know, we've moved on. And then I came to Butte, and they were like 20 years before I was born. Nothing had moved on. And I would get into these rip-roaring fights about, because they didn't understand that Ireland, you know, they're living in the Ireland of their grandparents. That is nothing like the Ireland today. I mean, it's a completely different country now. I mean, especially now, but I'm talking about 30 years ago when I moved to Montana. They were in the 1920s. They were at the time of independence when we had the Civil War. It was a sort of like being thrown back in time, and it was you know, for me it was a sort of eerie experience. But I understand it, and I you know, I mean, it's like they speak the way my uncles and great uncles would have spoken in Ireland. You know, now I sort of learned how to get out of these kind of arguments, because you really don't, but one good thing about the Irish is that you can have an argument, and yet the next, you know, few minutes later, you're having a pint and chugging it down, enjoying it, and you're all friends. I mean, you're not enemies forever. You can sit in the same room with people and have completely different points of view, and yet you can still be friends. And that's a very good trait, you know. But anyway, that brought me, I mean, two particular people who brought me back to my Irish heritage. One was Father Sarsfield O'Sullivan, who deceased now, but a wonderful man, a fellow. He knew Irish. His father was an Irish speaker who won a gold medal and a silver medal for his poetry in the Irish language, friend of De Valera's. His father was a friend of De Valera's. And as a little child of four, I think, when De Valera came and visited Butte. And then a most extraordinary thing happened. Our present president, Mary McAleese, was here a few years ago in Butte. And there was a luncheon for her, and Father O'Sullivan couldn't come to the lunch because he was ailing and weak, and she went to his house. So now here is a man, probably the only man alive, well, not alive, but the only man in history who had an Irish president visit his house when he was a little child, and who had an Irish president visit his house when he was 2 or 3 years away from death. You know, I mean, how many people have had an Irish president twice in their house? And this happened in Butte. I mean, that's a beautiful story. And it was wonderful that she went to see him. And the other person who's been a big sort of Irish connection for me is Father Gregory Burke. I don't know if you know him. You're probably not in Butte. But he's the reason. It is on his behalf that I'm giving this interview. That's because he's now, at this moment, he's in Cork and doing, just having a holiday. He's from Cork, he's from Bandon. And he's the last living Irish-born priest in our diocese, the Diocese of Helena. Yeah. And he's been a tremendous asset to this state. I think if you know, you can't say go to Butte and say his name without having an outpouring of love and admiration for him.
Just to kind of wrap up here, you know, being in Montana for the last 30 years, and the place is so much different, I feel, than any other place in the country, in that it does have all of this land and this space, and do you ever feel that same sort of, a different sort of groundedness and connectedness here in Montana than maybe in New York or other places? Or what is so different about Montana, and what keeps you here?
Well, this is it's a good question, because it's something I ask myself all the time. I have absolutely no reason to be here. I mean, I have to say that I love Montana. I love lots of aspects about Montana. Space. A certain thing about the people, a sort of honest, down-to-earth, people who are connected in some way to nature, a lot of the people here, who have a different sense of time than, actually they're much more prompt than people in New York or Ireland, which I've never caught on to that aspect of it. But they are, but there's, when I'm talking about time, I'm not talking about the clock. I'm talking about people who come out here, come out a lot of the time to enjoy the scenery, to enjoy all the good things Montana has. And then, of course, the people who live here think there is nowhere else. I mean, when I first came, people were always saying to me, gosh, aren't you glad you're here? And I wasn't thinking that at all. And they're saying, you know, you're so lucky, you know, to be away from New York and so on. And these people, I met more people who had never been outside of Montana when I first came. Now that's changed. But people who were absolutely content to be within the borders here. But what I love about it is that I can enjoy Montana, and I can enjoy the rest of the world too, because I never felt that I really belong to one particular place. I mean, I love my Irish heritage. I love having come from there. I have always used all the things I learned as a child, and especially about, you know, about what life is for, what the purpose of life, not sort of deviating. And there's a little bit of that in Montana, but I can get away, and then it's always nice to come back. You know, I can enjoy New York, I can enjoy Europe, I go to Ireland. Ireland is trickier, you know, because where you have, the Ireland that I have is probably not the Ireland, I mean, it's the Ireland of my childhood and my heritage, but it may not be the Ireland of today, you know.
Thank you.
Well, you're
so
very welcome.
Yeah. This was really lovely to speak with you.
Good.
And to meet you. So.